very much. Good song leading today. Glad to see everybody this afternoon. Glad that you're here. Hope that you've got your Bible with you and that you'll think about some of the things we're going to discuss this morning, this afternoon, whatever time of day it is. I've got a little book here I want to read a short selection from. This is a book that, actually this is a sermon I worked up a couple years ago. It's my December sermon, and so since I'm here in December this week, you get it this afternoon. But a couple years ago, my daughters were still living at home, and Charlie was a bit smaller, and so I homeschooled the kids, and we would spend afternoons, especially in the wintertime, we'd spend afternoons reading together, and we worked through a whole bunch of different books. This was one that we'd read in December. This is a classic story. You probably know it. This is Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Now, I don't know, some of you may have watched different adaptations of it. Some are better than others. I remember growing up watching the Disney one, and so that's the one I still have in my mind. I can still picture that one, and so maybe you're familiar with it, but there's a selection here. I want to read something. It won't take very long, let me just set up for you what's going on. So Scrooge, you're familiar with the story. Scrooge has left his counting house on Christmas Eve, and he's gone off. He's had his supper of gruel. I thought that was interesting reading through the book. He eats gruel for supper. And no wonder he's grumpy. He goes home, he goes and he eats gruel, and then he goes to his chamber. He goes to his house, and there he is sitting by himself, and the night grows long and dark, and then the specter, the spirit of his old business partner, Jacob Marley, comes to visit him. And so that's the scenario. That's what's happening. And this is part of the conversation between Marley and Scrooge. And so Marley's speaking. So this is what Marley has to say. He says, "O captive, bound and double ironed, not to know that ages of incessant labor by immortal creatures for this earth must pass into eternity before the good of which it is susceptible is all developed. Not to know that a Christian spirit working kindly in its little sphere, whatever it may be, will find in its mortal life too short for its vast means of usefulness. Not to know that no space of regret can make amends for one's life's opportunities misused." All this he's saying, I just didn't understand this when I had time. Such was I. Oh, such was I. And Scrooge responds, he says, but you were always a good man of business, Jacob. Business? Business, cried the ghost, wringing his hands again. Mankind was my business. The common welfare was my business. Charity, mercy, forbearance, benevolence, they were all my business. The dealings of my trade were but a mere drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business. Did you catch that? Mankind is my business. All the labors of my trade, no matter how seemingly important, but a drop of water in comparison to the ocean depth of my true business, mankind. Mankind is my business. And we know that. We know that. We know that to be true. The Bible clearly teaches us things like this, that life is about people, right? You know this. We instinctively know this, but God reveals this to us. Let me just share with you a couple passages. If you go to the book of Matthew chapter 25, so the way that this is set up is Jesus rides into the city of Jerusalem on a donkey, and what he's doing is he's announcing himself to be king. This is the way that the prophets had foretold the king of the Jews would present himself. And so Jesus does so. He rides in on this donkey, and he's being hailed as the king. Hosanna. He rides in, and the very first thing that he does is he goes to the temple and he throws out those who do not belong. He throws out the interlopers. He cleanses the temple. This is the Lord's house. This is my house. This is my throne. And he throws out those that don't belong. And then he pronounces divine judgment on those that have seated themselves in the chair of Moses, who've given themselves authority, the scribes and Pharisees. And he pronounces divine judgment on them in chapter 23. Then he pronounces divine kingly judgment on the city of Jerusalem as a whole in chapter 24. Chapter 25, then, are a couple of parables. You have the parable of the 10 virgins, the 5 wise, and the 5 foolish. And then you have the parable of the talents, followed by this picture of final judgment. And that's where I want to focus for just a moment. Matthew chapter 25. So in this scene of judgment, that's what all of this is about. Judgment, judgment, judgment. We have this picture of the last day and all the peoples who have ever been and ever will be. All the peoples are gathered here before the Lord Jesus, and he separates them one to his left and one to his right. And he passes judgment over them. And I want you to read with me. I want you to read with me and think about what the distinction between the righteous and the wicked is. In Matthew chapter 25. So we're going to pick up reading maybe in verse 34. So this is what Jesus says to the righteous. Then the king will say to those on his right, "Come ye who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. Naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. In prison and you came to me." And then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? And when did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or naked and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and come to you?" And the king will answer and say to them, "Truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, here are people that were paying attention to the least of them. You did it to me." And of course, the opposite then is true of the unrighteous. When did we see you hungry and not give you, Jesus, something to eat? If I'd have seen Jesus, I would have made sure that Jesus had food. I would have made sure Jesus had a place at my table. I would have made sure Jesus had a bed in my house. I would have made sure that Jesus would have had the things that Jesus needed. To the extent that you didn't do it to the least of these brothers of mine, you did not do so to me. Life is about people. Mankind is my business. That's what Jesus is talking about here. Of course we understand that. Of course we know that. Let me give you another example. Oh, before I finish that, before we finish this passage in Matthew chapter 25, that is not to say that baptism isn't essential, or that putting off sinful behaviors and putting on righteous behaviors, this matter of sanctification, that none of that matters. Not so whatsoever. No. He is highlighting the point that people matter. How we treat God's people is a direct reflection on how we treat Jesus. That's the emphasis here. It's not to the neglect of those other things, but the emphasis is that people matter. You can do all the right things. You can be a good church-going person. But if people don't matter in your life, if mankind isn't your business, then you're missing the whole of it. Mankind is my business. Let me give you another example. If you go to the book of 1 Corinthians... 1 Corinthians, this is chapter 8. Now, when Paul writes to the church at Corinth, if you've studied through 1 Corinthians before, you'll remember that the church at Corinth, they had all kinds of problems. And Paul's letter, 16 chapters in this first letter, Paul is addressing one problem after another. He just goes through in bullet points, and he deals with this issue, and then this issue, and then this issue. chapter 8, what he's talking about here, what the issue that he addresses is meat that's been sacrificed to idols. It seems that maybe there has been a letter from the Corinthians to Paul. He seems to address this in chapter 7 when he talks about some of the questions about marriage and relationships. It seems that there might have been some questions that the Corinthians had asked Paul, and since we don't have their questions, some of his answers are a bit cryptic because we don't know the context in which he's answering them. Be that as it may, here in chapter 8, he's answering this issue about eating meat that's been sacrificed to idols. Is it okay? Because we don't want to be guilty of idolatry, and so we don't want to participate in idolatrous practices like eating meat that's been sacrificed to idols. But on the other hand, there is only one true God, and so these idols, they're not real, and so this is just meat, and so we ought to be able to eat it. So which is right? And so you'll have brethren, you have Christians on one side who feel very strongly that it's wrong to eat meat that's been sacrificed to idols, and then you have other people on the other side who feel very strongly that, no, it is perfectly fine to eat meat that's been sacrificed to idols. And so what are we going to do with this, Paul? We've got this problem. Answer the question for us. Now, if you pick up reading in verse 1, I think it's interesting the way that Paul addresses this. Paul's a cheeky kind of guy. He gets a bit of a jab in here. At least that's what I hear. And test this out and see if this isn't so. Verse 1, now concerning things sacrificed to idols, we know, and if you read through 1 Corinthians, you'll remember that Paul often uses language about knowledge, and it seems to be a slight jab at them. We all know that we all have knowledge. If I paraphrase that, or if I put that in my own words, when you were in school, did your teacher ever have you read something and then ask you to put that in your own words? Put that in, you remember how hard that is? Put that in your own words. You have to understand it to be able to do that, right? And so if I try to put this in my own words, what I think Paul is saying is, we all know that we all have the answer. Now, your answer is different than mine, but I know that I'm right, and you know that you're right, and nobody's going to tell us different. We can be completely on the opposite ends of the answer, but you know that you're right, and nobody's going to tell you different, and I know that I'm right, and nobody can convince me otherwise. We all know that we all know. And so what does Paul say to that? Paul says, knowledge makes arrogant. Knowledge puffs up. I think that's the language of the King James. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. Love edifies. If anyone supposes that he knows anything, and they certainly have been supposing that, I've got the answer. I know. Everybody needs to listen to me. If anyone supposes that he knows anything, he has not yet known as he ought to know. He doesn't know as much as he thinks he does. But if anyone loves God, he's known by him. Now therefore, concerning the eating of things sacrificed to idols, we know that there is no such thing as an idol in the world, and that there is no God but one. For even if there are so-called gods, whether in heavens or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, from whom all things are, and we exist for Him, and one Lord Jesus Christ, by whom are all things, and we exist through Him. However, not all men have this knowledge, but some, being accustomed to idols until now, eat food as if it were sacrificed to idols, and their conscience being weak is defiled. And he's going to continue this on, but I want you to think about what happens here. So Paul answers the question, and the answer to the question is it okay to eat meat that's been sacrificed to idols? Yes, it's just meat. We understand that there are no other gods but one God. These are made up. These are make-believe. They do not exist. And so this meat that's been sacrificed to these made-up gods, it's still meat. Is it okay to eat meat that's been sacrificed to idols? Paul answers the question in just a verse or two, and he says, yes, it is. Now, he does go ahead and he does mention that idolatry is not something to play around with. And the forefathers, the children of Israel, got into all kinds of problems because they went after idols. And anyone who thinks that they stand and that they could never be tempted like our forefathers were, take heed that you do not fall. I think it's interesting that Paul answers the question in just a verse or two at the beginning of chapter 8. But this issue continues from chapter 8 into chapter 9 to chapter 10. And I think, it's my opinion, I think that it's even into chapter 11 where he uses the illustration of the head covering and the Lord's Supper to illustrate the points that he's making in these earlier chapters. So he answers the question about meat that's been sacrificed to idols in like a verse or two, but he spends four chapters explaining something else. And what is that other thing that he explains? How I deal with people. People specifically with whom I disagree, who feel differently about the issue than I do. He answers the question in just a verse or two, but he spends all of this time developing this thought of people. How do I interact with people? Because people matter. Life is about people. Mankind is my business. John chapter 21, here's just one more verse. John chapter 21, this is at the end, of course, this is the end of the Gospel of John. This is where Jesus has been resurrected, and he comes and he meets his disciples again on the seashore, and they recognize it's Jesus when he calls them to cast their nets into the sea, and they catch this great draught of fish, and it reminds them of these earlier times, and so they recognize that it's Jesus. They come out, and they have breakfast with Jesus. John chapter 21, you'll also remember that this is, what we're going to read about, this is where Jesus calls on Peter to confess his love. Peter had denied Jesus three times, and now he has an opportunity to confess his love for Jesus three times. And I really think that that's what's going on. People that know something about Greek want to make a big deal about the word love here, that there's two different Greek words. What I think's interesting is that there's a charcoal fire that's laid. There's a charcoal fire that's laid there in verse 9. So when they got out of the boat, or when they got onto the land, they saw a charcoal fire already laid. The only other place that word is used, the only other place that we find a charcoal fire in the Gospel of John is back in chapter 18, where Peter is warming himself around a charcoal fire, and it's there that he denies Jesus three times. I think that that's what's happening. Jesus is giving him an opportunity to confess his love three times, just as he had denied him three times. I think that's what's going on. But notice what's said here in verse 15. So when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" Now, I don't know specifically what the "these" things are. Is he talking about, do you love me more than these other disciples? Or do you love me more than your fishing gear? I don't know what the "these" things are, but whatever they are, Peter, do you love me more than the stuff? And what does Peter say? "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And so Jesus says to him, "Tend my lambs." And that scenario is played out all three of these times. Do you love me? Yes, you know that I love you. Of course I love you. Yes, Jesus, I love you. Then tend my lambs, feed my sheep. It's about people. It's about people. Mankind is my business. We see that all through the Scriptures. There's a number, there's verse upon verse upon verse that expresses this, and we know this. I'm confident that every one of you can envision or imagine or remember in your own memories. You can call back to mind a scene similar to the one I'm going to share with you just now. Years ago, my mom's family My mom's folks, where my mom grew up, just up the highway here, just north on the highway here in Hunt City, Illinois, my mom grew up on a little farm. And when I was a little boy, we would go at Christmas Eve, we would go to Grandpa and Grandma Brooks's house, go to the old farm place, because, you know, if you've got this side of the family and you got that side of the family and you only got one Christmas day, you kind of have to divide things up. And so Grandma Brooks's house was Christmas Eve. And so we'd drive out to Grandma Brooks's house, and we'd all pile into the farmhouse and got aunts and uncles and cousins galore, and everybody piles in here. And I don't know if some of you might remember things like this, but my Grandma Brooks had one of these aluminum Christmas trees. I don't know if any of you are familiar with an aluminum Christmas tree, but it was bright and shiny, and there were Christmas presents under it, and I knew that there was a Christmas present under it for me. But we had to have supper first. And you go over to Grandma Brooks's house, and Grandma would always have beef noodles and mashed potatoes, whether it was at Christmas time or is it Thanksgiving time or some random day in the summertime, it's going to be beef noodles and mashed potatoes. And so we'd sit down and we'd eat, and I can remember going to my dad after I'd cleaned my plate off, going over to my dad, running over to the adult table and asking my dad, is it present time now? Is it present time now? You know, it's all about priorities, and to a six-year-old, presents are the priority. No, not yet. The grown-ups are still eating. And of course, it looked to me like they were doing a whole lot more talking than they were doing eating. If they did a whole bunch more eating, they'd be done like me and we could get to the presents, get to the important stuff. Y'all have memories like this? I don't know what Grandpa gave me that year. I remember one year getting a sleeping bag. And one year, I remember Kevin and I, my brother Kevin, we both got to share a present. We got a red toolbox, and so we got to share that toolbox. One year, I got a pocket knife, and I wrote about this in my bulletin, and wanted to make sure I still got that pocket knife. Here it is. I carry that pocket knife still with me. It's not a special. It's not a good pocket knife. It's a Kmart pocket knife. I think that sleeping bag was probably a Kmart sleeping bag, too. I'm so eager to get to those presents. I suspect every one of you can identify with what I'm about to say. I'd trade every one of those presents that I ever got from my Grandpa Brooks. I'd trade every one of those presents. I'd trade this pocket knife without a second thought. I'd trade every one of those presents I ever got from him. I'd trade every present I ever got from him and from anybody else throughout my whole life if I could just have one more Christmas dinner with my Grandpa Brooks. Because life's about people. Mankind is my business. We all know that. Life's about people. There was a man that was dying of cancer. His widow told me, after he'd passed away, his last request to her, knowing that he was about to die, he didn't have but a day or two left, and you know, I suppose you just sometimes feel that in yourselves. And he had been sleeping in the living room on a medical bed, and he says to her, "You know what I'd really like to do? I'd really like to sleep in my own bed, and I'd like to sleep next to my wife one more time." Life's about people. Life is about people. And when I think about people, when I think about orienting my life around people, there's another word that I think has to be attached to it. And again, the Bible says all kinds of things about it. I want you to look with me, if you will, in the book of Romans. Book of Romans. We've already noticed this. We've already noticed this word as we've read through some of these other verses, especially that passage there in John chapter 21. But notice with me, if you will, Romans chapter 13. Romans chapter 13. I've got just a couple other verses I want to share with you, and then we'll just finish with that. Romans chapter 13, Paul says this in verse 8. He says, "Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law." Love one another. When I think about orienting my life around people, the word that comes to mind is this word of love. Love one another. And he continues on. He says, "For this, you should not commit adultery, you should not murder, you should not steal, you should not covet. And if there's any other commandment, it's summed up in this saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law." Love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. And Paul uses some of this Old Testament language, the covenant, the commandments. And then he draws that conclusion to love your neighbor as yourself. What does that mean? Well, look again at what he says there in verse 9. He says, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal. I do not want people stealing my stuff. And so I'm not going to steal their stuff. Love your neighbor as yourself. I don't want people murdering me. I really would be happy if people didn't hurt me. And so I'm going to do all that I can not to murder and hurt other people. Makes sense, doesn't it? You should not commit adultery. I don't want people flirting with my wife. I'm not going to flirt with theirs. Love your neighbor as yourself. Life's about people, and people are about love. Or again, back in the book of Matthew, in Matthew chapter 22, this is where Jesus is asked by the lawyers or by the Pharisees. There's one of them that's a lawyer. And he stands up and he asks Jesus, "What's the great commandment in the law?" And Jesus' response to him is, "The great commandment, the foremost commandment is this, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. And the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets." They're all summarized in these two laws. If I love God and if I love my fellow man, all the other things that God calls on me to do naturally fall under these. Love your neighbor as yourself. Or John chapter 13 and verse 35, where Jesus says that all men will know that you're my disciples by this. By what? How will all people know that we are His disciples? If you have love for one another. Life's about people. Life is about people, and people are about love. And of course, if we're going to talk about love, there's one verse that we cannot avoid. We cannot avoid. It's again in the book of 1 Corinthians. And at this time, Paul's talking about spiritual gifts. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, he began the conversation back in chapter 12. I'm not sure why, but tongues was the ability to speak in other languages, languages that you hadn't studied, languages that you hadn't learned. You just were able to speak in a different language. For whatever reason, that was the popular, that was the fad spiritual gift to have. And so everybody wanted it. And so Paul's talking about that. Look, there are a multitude of gifts. They're all given by the same Spirit, but there's a multitude of gifts, and they all are for the building up of the church. They're different gifts, just like our body has different parts of it, and we're glad that we have different parts. We're glad that we don't all have just a big head of ears. We're glad that we have different parts of our body, and they all serve different functions. And not one of them is more important than another. And so all of these gifts given by the same Spirit are for the building up of the body. They serve different purposes, but they all serve the body. And not one is more important than another. But Paul says, listen, even if you have the gift of tongues, not only if you had the gift of tongues, but if you had If you had all the tongues, if you had all the languages of men, matter of fact, even if you had more than the languages of men, even if you could speak in languages of angels, and I don't even know that there are languages of angels. I don't know that that's the point Paul's making. He's just saying, look, if you knew all of the languages and even heavenly languages or languages that nobody else could even imagine knowing, and if not only you knew that, but you knew you had the answer to every question, wouldn't that be great? You just knew the answer to every question that could come up. If you knew all of the answers, you understood all the mysteries of the world, you just had it on a Rolodex in your mind. You'd rattle off the answers. If you knew it all, but you don't love people, what does Paul say? You're just noise. More than that, you're not just noise. You are an obnoxious noise. You're an obnoxious, a clanging cymbal, an obnoxious noise if you don't have love, if you're not motivated out of love. And so Paul says, here's specifically what I mean when I say love. Love is patient. Love is patient. Love is patient. Love is kind. It is not jealous and it doesn't brag. It's not jealous of what other people have, and it doesn't make other people jealous of what I have. It doesn't brag. It doesn't take into account wrong suffered. I'm not keeping track. I'm not keeping a list, and I'm not keeping score. It doesn't rejoice in unrighteousness. When bad things happen to other people, even if it's their own fault, I'm not happy about it. It rejoices with the truth. It bears all things. It believes all things. It hopes all things. It endures all things. It endures all things. Listen, life is about people. People are our business. I am by nature an introverted person. And sometimes we introverted people use that as an excuse to ignore people, to isolate ourselves from people. Even for us introverted people, life is about people. Mankind is our business. And other people are really busy doing big things, important things, mighty things in this world, leading people. And sometimes because they're so busy doing big things, they have a tendency to step on the least of these, step on the little people. And sometimes they make excuses and say, but I'm doing big work. I'm doing important stuff in this world. My trade was just a drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business. Sometimes we use that as an excuse. This is big work. This is important work. Don't you know what we're accomplishing? And we step on other people. And again, we miss the point. Mankind, the people, are my business. If there's someone here today that we might pray for, that we might encourage in some fashion, in some way, you are our business. We invite you to come while we stand and sing.